Case number 22-3070, United States of America versus Robert Keith Backer, appellant. Mr. Kirsch for the appellant, Mr. Hobel for the appellee.
Good morning, counsel. Good morning. Mr. Kirsch, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, Stephen Kirsch on behalf of Robert Backer. And let me start out by saying that I fully appreciate the posture of the case. Mr. Packer has served his sentence that was imposed by Judge Nichols, and there was no supervised release as part of the sentence that was imposed on him. There does remain, however, a collateral consequence, which means the case is not moot. The collateral consequence was the imposition of whether we call it a fine or whether we call it restitution, but there was a monetary component to the sentence that was instituted or that was made part of the sentence. And we go back through the trial record.
Can I ask the restitution?
Yes.
$500 restitution?
Yes.
Well, that restitution is paying back sort of to the victim the damage caused. And that was due to his presence and participation at the Capitol, which wouldn't change. What evidence is there that turned at all on the length of his sentence?
Well,
he wouldn't have had the same $500 restitution even if he'd gotten, as Counsel Below had asked for, no prison sentence at all.
The amount of the restitution is discretionary, not a mandatory amount. The only mandatory assessment was the $10 assessment. So Judge Nichols had discretion to give a different amount of restitution. And I understand that it was part of the plea agreement that he agreed to restitution in the amount of $500. However, that was agreed to before Mr. Packer was made aware that this was an illegal sentence in violation of his First Amendment rights. So
before the sentencing hearing.
Yes.
And the restitution does that go to the architect of the Capitol, or where does that money go?
It goes to the architect of the
Capitol. For damage caused by his presence
yes.
there. So it has nothing to do with the length of his sentence.
It's not the length of the sentence, right. But it still is part of the imposition of the sentence. And I would emphasize to the court that where a trial court imposes restitution, there's a whole procedure that's outlined in the United States Code. It's 18 United States Code 3664, where before a sentence is imposed or restitution is imposed, there are requirements that the government has to introduce evidence, and the defendant has to introduce related to his indigency or his assets, and there has to be some sort of way to value the loss for the restitution because it is compensatory, but as the Supreme Court has said, it's also punitive. So there's two parts to it.
Is one of those factors the length of the sentence imposed in calculating restitution? Does the length of the sentence?
No. The length of the sentence does not matter in terms of the imposition of the sentence. So we would submit to the court that.
But have you considered sentencing guidelines too, that to the extent that you have a sentence of a certain length, later on, it could impose certain amounts of points, whether it's 1, 2, or 3, because you would have now had that prior sentence that could then make you have a higher guideline sentence the next time.
Well, that's correct. But as Judge Nichols acknowledged, everyone agreed, sentencing guidelines in this case were not an issue because it's a class.
Yeah, I understand that, not for here, but I'm right. saying the fact of having the conviction and then the sentence for another period later, then this becomes on the record and is a consideration for a higher sentencing guideline calculation.
Yes, it does. Yes, okay. It does. I mean, it follows Mr. Packer down the road. If he's ever convicted right. in the federal court, certainly that would show up as part of his.
But are you relying on that to counter mootness, that potential consequence? Are you relying on that? I mean, well, you started with the restitution.
Right.
Which I understand. And on this one, is the prospect that someone might commit another offense something that we take into account deciding whether a case is moot because the sentence has been served, or do we not factor in the prospect that someone will commit another offense, in which case there would be sentencing repercussions down the line?
Yes. Well, my primary argument is that the collateral consequence, number one, is the fact that there's restitution and it's a discretionary amount. But in response to Judge Child's question, I agree that this is something that should Mr. Packer again come before a federal court for sentencing on another matter, this will be a part of his sentencing guidelines.
It will be. It could be. I guess all I'm asking is, are you relying on that that second part of it in arguing against mootness, or are you only relying on the restitutionary award of $500?
We're incorporating both.
You're relying on the second part too. Yes. So your read of mootness principles is that we do take into account the possibility that the defendant might commit another offense, deciding whether the fact that the sentence has passed makes the case moot?
Well, there is a potential. That's correct. I mean, there is a possibility. There's a potential, but it's not. I would submit that the restitution order is definite. We know that there is an order of repayment, and that has not yet been satisfied. So to this day, whether we call it restitution or we call it a fine, still a requirement imposed on Mr. Packer. And I would also note for the court that reading the trial record, it's very ambiguous what Judge Nichols was saying. I understand he mentioned restitution at the sentencing hearing, but if you go back in the plea agreement itself, he talks very specifically, or the plea agreement talks very specifically about a fine, and then talks generally about restitution. And Judge Nichols also said in his sentencing allocution to the defendant, he said, well, I've imposed fines as low as $500. So clearly the notion of a fine was on his mind, and I believe that the record demonstrates that he conflated it. But we also take the position that it really doesn't matter, because the imposition of a monetary sanction is an adequate collateral consequence, such that this case is not moot. And getting to the substance, getting beyond the procedure, getting into the substance, there's no question, no one's disputing that the T-shirt bearing the words Camp Auschwitz was utterly offensive, and it was utterly offensive. But it is, Mr. Packer was still entitled to protect your First Amendment protections. And even though Judge Nichols sentenced Mr. Packer within the guidelines, he still had discretion. Now, Mr. Packer was sentenced to a period of incarceration of 75 days. He could have given him a lesser sentence, or he could have given him probation.
What's your argument as to the appeal waiver? Because that was raised by the government in its brief, and then we didn't get a response from you about the appeal waiver.
It's not waived, because our argument is that the sentence was illegal because it violated his First Amendment rights.
Is that your only reason? And I ask that because any plea and plea agreement should be knowing, voluntarily, and intelligently waived. And here, a plea agreement in and of itself doesn't get us, not necessarily do we rely only upon that, but you're only going to rely upon the plea colloquy by the judge. But there was no transcript, attached here.
Right. But our position is that when they went in for the plea and they went in and they submitted the paperwork, everyone assumed that this was going to be a constitutionally permissible plea. And it's after the plea is entered that the government files its very lengthy sentencing memorandum and highly emphasizes the T-shirt multiple times, talking about the Camp Auschwitz T-shirt. And then at the sentencing, Judge Nichols made very specific references.
Isn't it in the nature of an appeal waiver that it comes before sentencing that you don't know whether there's going to be a legal problem that arises in sentencing? And everybody understands that. But part of the bargain is, even though we don't know what the legal problem is that might arise, waiving the ability to challenge that on appeal.
I agree with Your Honor that this is something that you expect going into a plea, but you don't expect that the judge is going to violate your constitutional rights. So an appeal waiver is only good if the plea itself and the allocutions and the judge's sentence are legal. When they're illegal, then the plea waiver no longer is valid.
So if you thought that Judge Nichols, that the district court misapplied the guidelines, we wouldn't know that at the time that the appeal waiver was entered into, but then it comes to pass during the sentencing hearing that there's a misapplication of the guidelines, would you be arguing, well, nobody would have anticipated that there would have been a misapplication of the guidelines, and therefore the appeal waiver doesn't apply because everybody assumed that it would be done strictly in accordance with law, including the statute, including the guidelines?
I would argue that, and that specifically is permissible, and that's in virtually every plea in the district court, is that if the judge goes beyond the guidelines or doesn't follow the guidelines or doesn't give a good reason for going beyond the guidelines, that is appealable.
But here, when you, and again, you did not attach the transcript, but here we would be looking to the plea colloquy to understand that even if comments are made earlier or there's some reference to the T-shirt, it's at the time of sentencing when the judge kind of goes over the factors as to how they got to that particular sentence. Was that a consideration with respect to the T-shirt?
Yes, and we referenced that in the brief. And we made, I pointed out specific
parts. But what I'm talking about, you can have comments earlier on, you could have it in writing, you could have it orally at the plea colloquy. But when you get to the point of actually sentencing and the judge is providing their reasoning and their rationale, and there is no mention of the T-shirt at that time, would that make a difference?
Well, it could make a difference, but in this case, at the sentencing hearing, I mean, the judge specifically referenced the 3553 factors, went through the 3553 factors, but then he went into the T-shirt. And he assigned a nefarious intent to the T-shirt, and he said it's less for us to infer what the T-shirt means.
And you would suggest that that was occurring right at the time of the sentence,
yes.
Like as part of the factors.
Yes, and the best example I could think of, I mean, is that if Mr. Packer had been wearing a T-shirt that says, I support the First Amendment, if the words on the T-shirt were that, it would not have been a reference in the sentencing memorandum to those words, and it would not have been a reference by Judge Nichols when he imposed sentence to those words. It was strictly because it said Camp Auschwitz on it. And on the back, there were other offensive words. And there's no evidence in the record that that T-shirt was being worn to incite the crowd, to incite the riot, to advance Nazi theory. There's absolutely nothing in the record, which in the cases relied upon by the United States, those were factors where the court upheld using the offensive language as part of the sentence. Mr. Packer, there's nothing in the record to suggest any intent on his part. And the only reference in the record is that he was interviewed after he was arrested, and he was asked, why were you wearing that offensive T-shirt? And his answer was, because it was cold out.
Are you taking the position that what you characterize as an offensive T-shirt, that offensive T-shirt can't be taken into account at all, period, for sentencing purposes? Or are you taking the position that the district court didn't explain how it was taking it into account, and there may be some valid reasons to take it into account, but we don't know if it was for a valid reason or invalid reason? Because part of what you're saying makes it sound like you're suggesting that that fact can't be taken into account at all for sentencing, period.
Appreciate the court's question. If the offensive language on the T-shirt related to future dangerousness, then under precedent, yes, it could be taken into account. There's nothing here to suggest it could have been used for future dangerousness, because there was nothing in the record to support that. If the record showed that it was used to incite others to act in a certain way, then it could be used. So generally, there may be ways that it could have been relevant, but in this specific context, there was absolutely nothing in this record, nothing about the actions of Mr. Packer to support using that T-shirt in any way. And again, as Nichols says, he said he inferred some type of an intent from it. And that, we would submit, is violated Mr. Packer's amendment rights.
What if the sweatshirt said, stop the count?
I'm sorry?
What if the sweatshirt said, stop the count? Could that be considered in sentencing?
It may have been, because that's what the purpose of the rally was. But this was.
That's still First Amendment speech.
If it's used to incite action, and again, we need more facts to put it into context, it might be something that's useful. Another example I would use is, we go back to Charlottesville in 2017, where the people are marching, and they're chanting, "The Jews will not replace us." Mm-hmm. If he had been wearing a Camp Auschwitz T-shirt in that context, there may have been something that may have been a factor that a judge could have used at a sentencing hearing. But there's nothing in this record to come close to that, to support that. The only reference is he said he was cold. So there's nothing to show that he himself is a Nazi sympathizer. There's nothing to suggest that he was promoting Nazi ideology. or anything else. He's just wearing a T-shirt with offensive words and would submit that's protected.
It should, I mean, generally you would be providing the transcript under our appellate rules. Should we then on our own look at the transcript so that we can make an assessment?
Yes, certainly.
And can I just ask one more question about the sentencing, the appeal waiver? So just so I'm understanding your argument, I know that the appeal waiver provisions often have a carve out for sentences above the statutory maximum. So I'm not talking about a misapplication of the guidelines that would take you above the statutory maximum. I'm just saying that there's a guideline factor that is applied by the district court in a way that doesn't seem consistent with the guidelines, that there's legal claim that factor actually shouldn't have been applied in the same way. It doesn't come into play. Are you saying that the appeal waiver doesn't cover that kind of claim too, in the same way that it doesn't cover the kind of claim that you're making now? Or are you drawing a distinction with the type of claim you're making now?
I'm drawing a distinction because this is a violation of a constitutional right.
So you're saying constitutional claims are in a different category?
Well, yeah, in this category, yes, constitutional.
For waiver purposes, the way appeal waivers don't cover constitutional. That's your.
That would be our position, yes.
What is your particular relief that you asked for in this regard, because he's already served the sentence?
Well, we would ask for resentencing, to remand the case for resentencing, and for Judge Nichols to provide further explanation for the reasons. And the only remaining collateral consequence is the fine for reasons that do not pertain the T-shirt. And again, understand that this was agreed upon, but the judge doesn't have to follow that. Like in any agreed upon plea, trial judge 11C1C says you don't have to follow. Judges typically will, but they do make findings. But in this case, those findings were not made, and the judge could have.
Did he reference a sweatshirt at any time when he was discussing the amount of restitution ordered?
No, but he did.
You have the quotes about for the length of the sentence.
Yes.
But not for the restitution, which was agreed upon.
No, and he only briefly mentioned.
It was as low as he's ever gone before, anyhow.
That's correct. Well, yes, and he said it. That's as low as he's ever gone in the context of a fine.
Mm-hmm.
That position, it doesn't really matter, fine or restitution.
Right, whether it's called fine or restitution, it's the same for you.
In this context, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you this time. We'll give you a little time for
rebuttal. Thank
you. Counsel, Mr. Hobel.
May it please the court, Mark Hobel for the United States. This appeal should be dismissed as moot. Packer challenges only the length of his prison sentence. He's already served that sentence, and then he was released on December 30th. To the extent that he is now claiming there are continuing collateral consequences associated with the $500 restitution, that restitution, he agreed to pay it. It has nothing to do with the length of the sentence.
Could he raise restitution as a collateral consequence in his brief?
No, I don't believe he addressed restitution. I'm sorry, mootness at all in his brief, and he did not file a reply brief responding to our mootness arguments. I direct the court just to.
But he pretty clearly argued that he thought the length of the sentence imposed was impacted by the sweatshirt, impermissibly affected by the sweatshirt he was wearing, but he did not do that with respect to restitution.
That's correct, Your Honor. I just direct the court's attention to page 174 of the appendix. Which is the district court statement that Packer agreed to pay the $500 restitution. I think the court may have just misspoken when it said
that. But I'm not sure I follow the agreement part of it. You layered in two things. One is that there was an agreement, and the second is that the length of the sentence didn't vary based on it. Those two things don't necessarily go together. And if the agreement part of it, let's suppose restitution does turn on the length of the sentence, and the fact that he agrees to it as part of a plea agreement, would that mean that it doesn't get taken into account for mootness purposes? Because then if you could send it back, and then the restitutionary award would potentially be different, even though he agreed to it.
That's right. I'm tempted to say I think he'd still have a high hurdle on mootness given the agreement, but the key factor here, Your Honor, is that This is the length of his prison sentence had nothing to do with his with the restitution. So the argument today that, you know, notionally, if the case was remanded for resentencing on the length of the sentence, that the restitution would alter is just completely speculative. Remand for a resentencing would be an empty exercise. And so, you know, we would urge this court to dismiss this as moot. Let me just quickly address his point about future sentencing and that his sentence might be enhanced in the future. The Supreme Court of Spencer v. Temna has been was pretty clear on this, and we cited Spencer in our brief. A similar claim was likewise considered and rejected in Lane v. Williams because it was contingent upon respondents violating the law, getting caught, and being convicted. Respondents themselves are able and indeed required by law to prevent such a possibility from occurring. The speculative prospect that Packer might reoffend and be subject to additional sentencing, that's within his control. That's not sufficient to maintain standing where his release from prison has already mooted his challenge to the sentence.
Do you know if Virginia sentencing guidelines or whatever its sentencing system is, if he were convicted again under Virginia law, which is what his criminal history is, whether that would factor in this sentence?
I don't, Your Honor. I apologize.
There's some argument there that he's not in control of his behavior when it comes to alcoholism. So it's not so much the choice making that you just referenced in Spencer.
Right. I would just direct, you know, I'm not familiar with Virginia law or, but I don't think it matters, Your Honor. As a legal matter, the prospect of having your sentence enhanced in a future proceeding, that's insufficient to maintain standing to a sentencing challenge.
Mm-hmm. And back to the restitution one more time. Sorry, I know you want to move on, but you said it's speculative, but the legal factors that courts consider in setting the amount of restitution, the facts and the legal principles that they consider, does length of sentence, at least for misdemeanors like this, factor in at all?
Your Honor, I have to apologize. I'm not sure I'm prepared to answer that, in part because I'm hearing for the first time today the restitution response to our mootness argument, because again, Packer did not file a reply brief. I note here that on this record, there is no connection between the length of the sentence that he received and the restitution he paid. The district court here carefully went through all the sentencing factors, considered the nature of his conduct, his background. The restitution, because he agreed to it, was sort of imposed at the end without much discussion. It wasn't part of the discussion of the factors.
And he had agreed in advance in the appeal, or sorry, in the in his plea agreement to the $500 for restitution.
You know, unfortunately, off the top of my head, I don't remember. I think that's what Mr. Kearse said earlier. But, you know, certainly at the time.
He hadn't agreed to the amount of sentence, the length of the sentence in the agreement.
He had not. But, you know, right. He did obviously appeal his right to, he did waive his right to appeal the sentence unless it was over the statutory maximum. Everybody's agreed here that the sentence he received is below the 6-month statutory maximum. So, you know, even if the court were not to, were to disagree with us on mootness, we'd ask this court to follow its ordinary course and enforce the appeal waiver. I know, Judge Childs, you'd asked about the plea transcript. We did not have that at the time that we filed our opposition brief, but we filed a copy of the plea transcript last week. The district court did review the terms of the appeal waiver with Packer. Did accurately state you're waiving your right to appeal unless I give you a sentence above the statutory maximum, which did not occur here. So this is not a case like Kaufman, which Packer cited in his opening brief, in which the district court essentially rewrote the terms of the appeal waiver on the spot during the plea colloquy. The district court accurately repeated the terms of the plea of the appeal waiver and the plea agreement. Those terms should be honored here. And
so we do have decisions on appeal waivers that say that there are certain situations in which we won't enforce an appeal waiver. And one of them is when the sentencing court, what we said, is rests a sentence on a constitutionally impermissible factor. such as the defendant's race or religion.
That's correct, Your Honor. The court did say that, and I believe the Gilling case, and we cited that in our brief. That did not occur here.
Isn't that his claim, that the sentence, it's based on a constitutionally impermissible factor?
That is his claim, Your Honor, and I'm happy to address it. That did not occur here. The sweatshirt was, you wore it during his participation in the mob.
That's on the merits of the claim, and I want to hear your argument on the merits, but I guess what I'm asking is in terms of the waiver. If that's a basis to not enforce a waiver, then the enforceability of the waiver doesn't turn on whether the claim is valid or not at the end of the day.
Right. And I think what it in effect does is it narrows the scope of the permissible claim he could bring. So, for instance, Chief Judge Srinivasan, you had asked Mr. Kearse whether he was appealing whether the district court was, gave a sort of sufficiently detailed explanation for his reasons for relying on the sweatshirt in part. That type of claim would be barred by the appeal waiver, clearly going to sort of a procedural reasonableness of imposing the sentence and relying on that fact. So it does narrow the scope of the claim. And to reach through the appeal waiver, to reach through mootness, too, which we can't have done. But Mr. Packer really has to argue that the have to be a very blatant person in violation. That's not. I mean, Packer was wearing, it said Camp Auschwitz, staff at Camp Auschwitz, applying identification with death camp guards at the scene of the rally. To the extent that Packer is now arguing that a stop the steal sign would be something permissible to consider because it shows your purpose or intent in joining the riot. Certainly, Camp Auschwitz sweatshirt demonstrates or at least raises an inference of purpose for intent and motive for joining the riot.
How does it connect to this? I mean, he made the distinction between maybe the Charlottesville March and this one. So that's what I didn't see from the district court, and I'm not naturally getting is what is the connection?
So I like to quote, Your Honor, from the government sentencing allocution where we did draw this connection, pages 148 to 49 of the appendix. We stated, and Mr. Packer was everywhere that violence happened, except for the rotunda in the East Stores, Your Honor. He was everywhere else. He broadcast his intention for joining the riot. He wanted to support the subversion of our republic and keep a dictatorial ruler in place by force and violence. And his words on his clothing showed you his intent. I note too.
So his intent was?
In order to participating in the mob, the inference that the shirt raises is that in participating in the mob attack in the Capitol, he was seeking to participate in the violent overthrow of our democracy, our republic. He's not in his sentencing memorandum, he compared himself to Forrest Gump, to sort of a passive, peaceful observer. And the shirt truly belies that characterization, was highly relevant in sentencing. I note too, in addition to his purpose and motive, which
so the point was this to connect to like a white supremacist desire to overthrow the government? Is that the connection between the Camp Auschwitz and I would get like the Stop the Steal or stop government can't be trusted or something like that. But it requires a little more inferring or stretch here to get the connection, at least in my eyes, a disgusting and appalling sweatshirt. But we have to be really, really careful in this country about when First Amendment protected activities can be a basis for imprisonment. That's something very important in this country. And sometimes I can, certainly if it really is right in the heart of the matter, let's take over the Capitol shirt would be perfectly relevant. But this one is, you got to admit, it's a few steps away.
No, and I want to be clear too that the government is being careful here and is being sensitive to these First Amendment concerns. I mean, I do think that when Mr. Kearse said that the government really emphasized this shirt in our sentencing memo, that's just inaccurate. I mean, we did not foreground this shirt except to the extent that we said it was distinctive, which enables, and we included a number of pictures and screenshots from video to show Packer going to the Capitol. And we also noted that his answers to the FBI about why he was wearing it, he was cold, were his answers, that you know, indicates that he was not completely forthcoming with the FBI during his debrief. And, you know, that does go to the extent of remorse. So we did not heavily emphasize this, despite what Mr. Kirsch says in our memorandum. But,
well, if it's relevant, then there's no reason not to emphasize it. That's what, so I'm not.
Right.
I'm just trying to get the connection as to relevance, because this one seems to me harder to link up than a lot of other things one can imagine. And again, the First Amendment is, it's really, really important that we not imprison people for speech.
Well,
unless their speech is criminal.
Understood. I would argue that the inference does there is a clear inference linking a Camp Auschwitz sweatshirt, an SS t-shirt that's worn underneath it, to white.
Nobody saw that.
Right. And I know too, you know, there are other legitimate sentencing purposes here. That shirt conveys a threat. It's intimidating. It expresses essentially that this person, that Packer, sympathizes with, you know, the people who killed millions of Jews and others in the Holocaust. And, you know, it's also as to future dangerousness. And Mr. Kirsch even, I believe, acknowledged that. We cited to United States v. Schmidt, a recent Seventh Circuit case, in which, you know, unlike in this case where there was a clear connection between the crime and the expression or the belief of Nazism, in Schmidt, it was a felon in possession case where there was not a connection between the crime, a clear connection between the crime and the Nazi beliefs. But the Seventh Circuit still upheld the district court's reliance on it based on the threat of future dangerousness.
In the Gilling case, it mentions a waiver does not shield from review a sentence colorably alleged to rest upon a constitutionally impermissible factor. So I want you to focus on the word colorably.
Right. We would disagree that Packer has raised a colorable First Amendment claim here. This is a, this is not a situation like the Lemon case, this court's precedent, in which there were no facts connecting. You know, in that case, it was a check cashing case, a bad check cashing case, and there were no facts connecting the defendant's association with the Black Hebrews group and the crime. Here, there is a clear connection between the crime and the shirt. He was wearing the shirt during the crime, and the district court was permitted to draw reasonable inferences that on that from that. And the First Amendment did not stand in the way of the district court considering. But you know, in the end, I'd return to the mootness point. That there is no effective remedy here. He's already served his sentence. We would ask this court to dismiss this case as moot and leave the district court's judgment in place. Unless there are any further questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rebell. Mr. Kirsch, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Going back to United States versus Lemon, which is cited in our brief. This court, and Lemon's still good law, this court, and it's already been referenced by this panel, but this court very specifically said that a sentence based any degree on activities or beliefs protected by the First Amendment is constitutionally invalid. And we would submit that is why this case should not be dismissed, and that is why this case clearly falls within Mr. Packer's statutory right to appeal, regardless of the fact that he said he wasn't going to appeal, but that acceptance was made before he knew that there was going to be an illegal sentence imposed. And then the government argues, and again, this court has to make the final determination, but the government continues to argue that there's no connection between the, government argues there is a connection between the t-shirt and the crime. It's not correct. There clearly is no, that I can see from the record, any connection between the crime and the t-shirt. There's no reference, there's nothing, there are no remarks by Mr. Packer. There's nothing from which this court can infer there's a connection, but Judge Nichols did make that inference. He said, I have to infer this is the nefarious intent. We submit that was improper. So for all those reasons, we would submit that this case, that Mr. Packer did not waive, this case is not moot, and that his First Amendment rights were in fact. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. Take this case under submission. Mr. Kirsch, you were appointed by the court to assist the appellant in this matter, and the court thanks you for your assistance.